Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hours Editorial Review. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hours Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and worldwide on the Internet. More information about the Editorial Review and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events in the light of Bible prophecy, biblical law, and scriptural history. So stay tuned for tonight's special reports right after this message. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? That bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights, and permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level, from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, your property from these incessant attacks by government agencies like OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agencies and agents that are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot you can do. And the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first, and let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. It's educational, entertaining, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And the number to call, 417-273-4967, to order yours today. Now, if you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email and request your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Drought has overtaken the western United States for the past 6 years. We're now headed into another year of drought. It's an ugly word. Its very mention evokes images of desolation and suffering. In the Old Testament, its mere mention suggests punishment by Yahweh. In some instances regarding that punishment, Scripture is not only prophetic, but quite relevant to our modern times. In Genesis 41, verses 28 through 32, there is a story that says, "It is as I have told Pharaoh, God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is going to do. 7 years are coming, bringing great plenty to the whole land of Egypt, but 7 years of famine will follow them, when all of the plenty in the land of Egypt will be forgotten, and famine will exhaust the land. The famine that is to follow will be so severe that no one will remember what plenty the country enjoyed. And the reason why the dream came to Pharaoh twice is because the event is already determined by God, and God is impatient to bring it about." Remember, that's Genesis 41, 28 through 32. Well, today, ignored by most Americans until they see either their national forests burning or their hillside homes going up in flames, or a sudden increase in the price that they're paying for their food down at Kroger's, and even ever-growing drought has been taking its destructive toll in the Great Plains and the western United States, that is, most of the western United States. And Rick Ochoa, weather program manager of the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho, warns that we are headed into the sixth year of drought, and some areas are looking at their seventh year of drought. Consistently warmer weather and a diminished snowpack share some blame for these conditions, but agriculture's and the West's relentless, often wasteful thirst for cheap water remains the chief culprit. For example, irrigators in western Nevada are threatening war with a country club that wants green grass for a national golf tournament. In a most perceptive and rewarding feature, an article appeared in the May 4th issue of National Geographic, Change of Heartland, America's Great Plains. And the writer, John G. Mitchell, notes that the weather wasn't especially kind to the plains at the dawn of the new millennium. Drought swept the region from Montana and the Dakotas south into Texas and eastern New Mexico. The high plains of eastern Colorado turned to powder. Backhoes and bulldozers were summoned to clear county roads of wind-blown dirt. Newspapers proclaimed 2002 the driest year since the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, and in parts of the northern plains, the year was the driest in more than 100 years. So the pumps and the windmills and the center pivot sprinklers sucked at the earth more urgently. Under the Panhandle Plains, the level of the great Ogla-Ogla aquifer plummeted closer to depletion. And yet, once again, the lessons of recent history appear lost to most users of this nation's most precious limited natural resource, and that's water. Siegfried Schubert of the NASS Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, who recently led a research team studying the causes of the 1930s Dust Bowl, told Nature News Service, quote, "The Dust Bowl is unique in the last 100 years, and that is because of the unusual combination of the Pacific and Atlantic effects. In believing that unusual sea surface temperatures, NASA's climate researchers feel their work could help predict future dry spells, and it demonstrates that tiny changes in ocean temperature can have a massive impact on the land." Now, called by some one of the three worst ecological blunders in history, the Dust Bowl was a mere 50 years in the making. Donald Worster, in his authoritative investigation, Dust Bowl, the Southern Plains in the 1930s, vividly describes this tragedy and sees more than just nature on a rampage. My argument is that there was, in fact, a close link between the Dust Bowl and the Depression, that the same society produced them both, and for similar reasons. Both events revealed fundamental weaknesses in the traditional culture of America, the one in ecological terms and the other in economic terms. Both suffered a reason and an opportunity for substantial reform of that culture. It came about because the expansionary energy of the United States had finally encountered a volatile, marginal land, destroying the delicate ecological balance that had evolved there over millennia of time. We speak of farmers and plows on the plains and the damage that they did, but the language is inadequate. What brought them to the region was a social system. It was a set of values. It was an economic order. And there is no word that so fully sums up those elements as capitalism. In explaining his meaning, Worster points out that capitalism has developed an enduring ethos that seeks to give the economic culture continuity. The ecological values of that ethos include: nature must be seen as capital. Man has a right, even an obligation, to use his capital for constant self-advancement. And the social order should permit and encourage this continual increase of personal wealth. Well, by the 1920s, farming and ranching had become for many a business, the object of which was not necessarily to make a living, but to make money. And just as they objected to the social controls that they perceived Roosevelt's New Deal was trying to impose upon them. They also believed that nature would dare not thwart them in the managing of their business affairs. Thus, these same lazy fair interests continued to extensively plow up the Great Plains, planting their wheat, and creating highly mechanized factory farms that produced unprecedented harvests. As Worcester continues, there was nothing in the Plains society to check the progress of commercial farming, nothing to prevent commercial farming from taking the risks that it was willing to take for profit. And that's how, and that's why, the Dust Bowl came about. The Dust Bowl was only an extreme example, however, of the serious drought which threatened the greater part of the nation in the 1930s. And yet, if one uses a precipitation deficiency of at least 15% of the historical mean to define drought, the only states that escaped drought from 1930 to 1936 were Maine and Vermont. Intense heat also accompanied this drought in many areas of the nation. Centered around liberal Kansas, the Dust Bowl stretched 400 miles north to south and 300 miles east to west. It included 151,000 square miles of area. It included western Kansas, southeastern Colorado, northeastern New Mexico, and the panhandles of Oklahoma and Texas. It was in this region where the black blizzards of the 1930s struck with all of their fury. It was on April 17, 1935, that a 200-mile-wide dust storm with 1,000-feet-high dust clouds rolled along the ground at speeds of 60 miles an hour, keeping some towns in nighttime blackness for more than 3 hours, and stretched across Kansas, eastern Colorado, and into Texas and Oklahoma. Dust from these storms, such as these, found its way to the streets of New York and Washington, D.C. The estimated financial cost of just the 1934 drought alone amounted to one-half of the United States cost in World War I. By 1936, farm losses had reached $25 million a day, as more than 2 million farmers were drawing relief checks. And you could look out the window and watch Kansas go by. It was the way one Midwesterner put it to a reporter. The wind blew everything into old Mexico except the mortgage, was the observation of another farmer. Now, most farmers gladly accepted their relief checks in the form of federal dollars, along with the federal government's inevitable reassurance, solicitation, and encouragement. However, when the New Deal policies attempted to become innovative, many Plains people turned hostile, and the fate of the Plains lay in the hands of Providence, and Providence, not Washington, would see them come out all right. It was a popularly expressed sentiment at the time, notes Worcester. Now, what the Plainsmen needed was hope, of course. But the mature hope that does not smooth over failure, deny responsibility, or prevent basic change. They needed a disciplined optimism tempered with restraint and realism toward the land, but all that required a substantial reform of commercial farming, which neither Roosevelt nor most of his New Deal advisors or cronies were prepared or able to bring about. Even as it evolved toward a more comprehensive program, the New Deal did not aim to alter fundamentally the American economic culture. Washington became and remained throughout the decade a substitute for benign trying to give sleep their next year. All right, hang on. Thank you. All right, we're back. You're listening to The Law Hour's Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest, and all of these Editorial Review programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Well, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits has produced greater efficiency and security, all right. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American. That's 15 files on every one of us. Now, that's according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. So 15 isn't the total. That's just the federal government's total. Now, a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And each system contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, all of this information about you is gained from 63 sources. And all of this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and a very logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how government, banking, insurance, business, and industry obtains all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? And how do you keep it away from them? Well, knowing how this information is gathered, what information is stored, and what information you want to keep personal and private, actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and just ask for my free general law CD package, and I'll tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. All you have to do is call 417-273-4967 to order yours. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, extreme drought best describes parts of the West and Northern Great Plains, and from the brittle hillsides of Southern California to the drying fields of Idaho, from Montana to New Mexico, a relentless drought is worsening across most of the West. Water supplies are dwindling, and the threat of wildfires is rising. Most of the West is headed into 6 years of drought, and some areas are looking at 7 years of drought, said Rick Ochoa. He's the weather program manager at the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho. Arizona is facing its worst drought on record. There's never been anything like it. Two enormous reservoirs on the Colorado River are only half full. Some farmers in southern Idaho may not get any irrigation water this summer. Irrigators in western Nevada are threatening war with a country club that wants green grass for a national golf tournament. The mountain snowpack, a crucial reservoir that in a good year holds water until it's needed, was half of the normal for March, or less in many areas. Now, we had one of the warmest Marches on record, and we didn't get any precipitation almost anywhere in the West, said Kelly Redmond. He's the regional climatologist for the Desert Research Institute's Western Regional Climate Center in Reno, Nevada. So not only did we not add to our supply in March, which is usually a very healthy month, but the temperature was so warm that the melting started early. Now, the mountains of Colorado and northern New Mexico got more than a foot of snow this weekend, and meteorologists said the Albuquerque area could be looking at record rainfall this month, but it's only a start toward a needed recovery. It'll help. It just depends on how soon the next one comes, said farmer Larry Pulser of Colorado's Washington County. It'll buy us some time. The U.S. Natural Resources Conservation Service said there's a potential for water restrictions and widespread crop and pasture losses in central Nevada, southern Idaho, most of south central Montana, and eastern southwestern Utah. Most of southern Idaho and parts of southwest Montana are in exceptional drought. That's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That is a step worse than extreme drought, which the USDA said best describes other parts of Montana, Utah, Wyoming, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, Oregon, and Colorado. With dry trees raising the risk of wildfires, it's not just farmers who will be hurting. Already this year, 10,000 acres have burned in Arizona, along with 8,500 acres in Colorado. In terms of fire, I think everybody is very nervous, said Chris West. He's the vice president of the American Forest Resource Council in Portland, Oregon. The National Interagency Fire Center said that the greatest fire risks were in Southern California, the Four Corners region of Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah, and the Intermountain region of Idaho and western Montana. Now, researchers claim that the 1930s Dust Bowl created by unusual sea surface temperature that we're beginning to see right now. Now, the devastating U.S. drought of the 1930s was caused by unusual sea surface temperatures, according to new climate research. And the work could help predict future dry spells and demonstrates that tiny changes in ocean temperature can have a massive impact on the land. The researchers fed sea surface temperature data from the tropical Atlantic and Pacific Oceans into a computer model, which accurately predicted the drought that affected three-quarters of the United States between 1931 and 1939. The Pacific was, on average, a few tenths of a degree cooler than normal during the 1930s. And while the Atlantic was slightly warmer, this combination was apparently enough to turn the southern plains, including parts of Colorado, Texas, Kansas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico, into a giant dust bowl. The dust bowl is unique in the last 100 years, and that's because of the unusual combination of Pacific and Atlantic effects. Now, that was a statement from Siegfried Schubert of the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. He was the leader of the research team. More than 2 million farmers were forced from their land as the soil dried out. And at the time, the 1930s, it was estimated that almost 1 billion tons of topsoil blew off the southern plains in 1935. Now, once the soil had dried out, there was less evaporation. This meant even less rainfall. This formed a positive feedback loop that probably doubled the effect of the drought, says Schubert. They report their findings in the March 19th issue of Science magazine. Researchers know that sea surface temperatures can have a profound effect on precipitation. We know that from El Nino. Changes in the Pacific can cause tornadoes over Florida and droughts in Africa. Jonathan Bamber is a climatologist at the University of Bristol. And it is very surprising that these small temperature variations could cause such a huge drought, said Schubert. Now, the Great Plains get most of their rain in spring and summer. The westerly trade winds that flow around the equator normally carry moisture westwards from the Gulf of Mexico over the United States, keeping the plains well watered. But a warmer Atlantic heats the air just above the sea surface, making it less dense. and allowing it to rise, explains Bamber. And this opens the door for cooler high pressure air that sweeps eastwards off the continental American landmass. So the wet air over the Gulf flows eastwards instead. And the same trade winds usually sweep westwards over the continent and the Pacific, picking up moisture from the ocean as they go, before doubling back and then carrying their watery cargo back towards the United States in the upper atmosphere. Now, a cooler Pacific disrupts this cycle so that the air returning to the United States is drier, flows at a lower altitude, and is less likely to bring rain to the plain. Schubert believes that his team's computer model should work just as well for the Sahel region of Africa on the southern edge of the Sahara Desert, where changes in Atlantic and Indian Ocean sea surface temperatures are creating droughts. Now, at the moment, the model can give about 6 months to a year advance warning of a drought, including deep ocean temperature measurements in the calculations, which could improve its predictive power, says Schubert. Modern farming practices, such as improved irrigation, would moderate the effects of any future droughts, but the basic weather that caused the Dust Bowl will almost certainly happen again, Schubert warns. Over the last 500 years, we've had these kinds of mega droughts about once or twice every century. Historically, these events are not only very likely, they are inevitable. And that's where we are with the drought problem in the West. Now, it lasted from 31 to 39 the last time, so we're talking about 9 years. Now, we're entering into the sixth year, and in some regions, the seventh. So it may be a while before we get through this drought cycle. And it's exacerbated by the farming practices, the industrial farming practices that we've been using in this country for about 100 years. Now, here's a story that came in today. I was encouraged to put this one on. If you have a computer, pay attention, because millions of computers worldwide have been hit by an internet worm, experts say. Millions of computers have already been infected by a new internet computer worm that caused disruptions over the weekend and may spread rapidly when businesses resume work Monday morning, experts warned. Now, the worm is named Sasser. It began to spread on Saturday, and unlike a virus, does not travel through emails or attachments. It can spread by itself to any unprotected computer linked to the Internet. It attacks through a flaw in recent versions of Microsoft's Windows, Windows 2000 news websites, Windows Server 2003, and Windows XP news websites. And it causes the computer to shut down, then rebooting it, repeating the process several times, but it appears to do no lasting damage. The antivirus company, Panda Software, said Sunday that slightly more than 3% of the world's computers, around 18 million, out of the estimated 600 million computers operating worldwide, have already been affected. Now, compared to other viruses which have appeared on weekends when activity is low, doubly so now that May 1st is a holiday in many countries, this one has positioned itself as one of the quickest spreading and the most virulent viruses to ever come along to hit computers. Louis Corons of Panda Labs, which has offices in Spain and the United States, said Sunday. All these signs make for a dark forecast for the beginning of the week when it's expected that the number of incidents will soar at the beginning of the work day. Now, the problem seems to be getting worse. Miko Hypoian an antivirus expert at F-Secure, a leading internet security firm, told AFP from Helsinki, adding that millions of computers worldwide may have been infected. Now, we don't know how big this is going to be, but we expect things to get much worse on Monday when people bring their laptops into the office after the weekend. Since laptops are not protected by company firewall systems, if used on a server other than the company's server, they run the risk of being infected and then in turn infect the company's network when used in the office. Now, it seems to me an exaggeration to say that millions of computers have been affected. Microsoft's technical director in France told AFP, where work was disrupted by the worm on Saturday night, but he did acknowledge that the worm was spreading on Sunday. Now, we are recording at the moment several attacks a minute on honeypots, computers that are deliberately left unprotected so they can monitor viruses. And he said, adding that France and some Southeast Asian countries seem to be particularly hard hit. Microsoft made available a software update last month to fix this flaw exploited by this worm, and since mid-April, several million copies have been downloaded. Now, we have every hope that the spreading of this virus will be limited by the many precautions that we've taken, he said. It is not possible to give a figure for the spread of the virus, still less the cost of the damage that it's going to do, he said. Well, hang on. Back to the balance of that story. We should come back. You've got a laptop computer to plug it in to your office computer. You're listening to the Editorial Review. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Editorial Review is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. And your support of Truth Radio and of our advertisers and sponsors is very important to us. So for more information about Truth Radio Network programming, please go to our website. That's truthradio.com, truthradio.com. And remember, the Truth Radio Network is a private volunteer organization. We're established as a private charitable trust for the purpose of exercising and defending free speech. Truth Radio is not a 501c3 tax-exempt institution. Donations are, therefore, not tax-deductible. If they were tax-deductible, we wouldn't be free to tell the truth. So instead, we rely upon the financial support of our listening audience to help us pay for our satellite time, our internet audio streaming, and our overhead costs. And we thank you very much for your help and participation and partnership in your financial support, which comes through your donations that you make here to Truth Radio. Thank you very much. Truth Radio is at P.O. Box 344 here in Napomo, California, 93444. Again, that's Truth Radio, Post Office Box 344, Napomo, N-I-P-O-M-O, California, 93444. Here's tonight's wise old saying. Even a fool is counted as wise when he holds his peace. All right, we're talking about this computer virus. It's got a funny name here. I've never heard this name before. They call it, let me flip back over here and give you this name again. Sasser, S-A-S-S-E-R. Our computer man came in today and he said, well, here's a note. You ought to spread this out to all of your listeners. This virus, he told me, is not incident to your email, which most of these viruses come in over your email. He said, just having your computer plugged in, it will come in. Or if you've got it on your laptop, when you go in and put this, your laptop information into your computer, for some reason it's unprotected. You need to have a firewall, he told me. You need to have a protection that protects against these viruses coming in. And there was a glitch in this Microsoft computer. And I happened to watch the neighbor over here. He got in on the last virus over here, and he never could get his computer back up and running. He brought it over here to Dirk, and they worked on it for a while, and they couldn't figure it out. And so he had to scrap it and buy a new one. Now, I didn't know these viruses were that way, that it could wreck your computer, that is, if you can't fix it. So tuck that one away in your heart. And the balance of the story goes like this. He says it's not possible to give a figure for the spread of this virus, adding that many firms never admit being infected and that if small and medium-sized businesses did not take precautions on Monday morning, Sasser could be spreading rapidly. In Moscow, the Russian computer security firm Kaspersky Labs warned of a possible major epidemic when business activity resumes on Monday. For a moment, or for the moment, the extent of the epidemic isn't that severe, only because most people aren't at work yet, and their computers are shut off. For the moment, the worm, the third major internet infection this year after MyDoom A in January and Beagle B in February, does not appear to be a worldwide phenomenon. One American specialist reported only a few hundred computers infected. Another did not rank Sasser in its 10 most common infections. An expert said that they did not know who started the virus, but Alfred Huger, he's the head of the engineering at or head of engineering at California-based computer security firm Symantec. He said it was started deliberately by someone. Of that much we're sure, he said, and what we're not sure of is that individual's motives, because the virus is not doing any damage and it's not installing a back door which would have future access to other viruses. We'll just have to wait and see, he said. This worm is unlike previous worms in that it does not appear to be causing any great damage to computers, said Huger. It will slow your computer down, but there does not appear to be any direct damage to the hard drive. All right, so there's a little story on Sasser, the virus. There's a little story here on ethanol. The Senate's thumbs-down vote on April the 29th may mark the beginning of the end of the ethanol reign of terror, particularly as uncertainty spreads across the countryside over the future of corn-based fuel additive. Without a major legislated market expansion, the tide may head out for ethanol for several reasons. Now, ethanol plants coming online are now under development were predicated on the belief that the new markets would develop. When Tom Daschle first proposed the tripling of mandated ethanol use in the so-called reformulated fuel standard back in 2002, little did he realize that the ethanol juggernaut would encounter such serious resistance. Moreover, with corn prices rising, ethanol plants are now losing money since they require lower-priced corn and or other feedstocks to be viable. As motorists fume over rising gasoline prices, the realization is also spreading that ethanol blending is a primary factor in the spiking prices at the gas pump. With less ethanol and a phase-out of the only other oxygenate, MTBE, you can expect higher prices. Ethanol's environmental claims that it burns cleaner are also being challenged. Following the explosion and sinking of the ethanol tanker off Virginia earlier this year, with the loss of 21 lives, officials are also beginning to focus on the significant transport environmental risks that this volatile fuel carries. Explosions and fires with loss of life is more common at ethanol plants than its proponents will admit, even as they go to great lengths to hush up such disasters. The sweep of damages are being swept out of the public eye. Now, with voter anger rising and November's elections on the horizon, you can be sure that the tired old blame game will develop. Daschle has already started the finger-pointing after the 59-40 drubbing on April the 29th, claiming that the Republicans killed the ethanol bill. He is in a tight race for the U.S. Senate in South Dakota with John Thune. Now, right about now, investors in ethanol plants have got to be very nervous. Perhaps you can remind them that once a few cards are pulled from this phony Rube Goldberg scheme, the whole thing could collapse very quickly, leaving them and their investors holding the bag. Ethanol's 800-pound gorilla is the Archer Daniels Midland Company, and they also will be hurt, but not nearly as much as the little producer investors, since ADM has plenty of traditional ag business trading and dozens of food or feed ingredients to fall back on. And they also have offshore, non-corn-based ethanol feedstocks to tap. For example, fermented table wine sugar that they can use to meet their contract obligations. If ethanol or the dubious requirement for its use disappeared tomorrow, fuel prices for U.S. motorists would quickly start falling. Now, there's another story here that just came in, a recall of 22 tons of Cargill ground beef as sample tests positive for E. coli. This is the E. coli 0157H7. The Excel Corporation, a division of Cargill Meat Solutions, is voluntarily recalling about 45,000 pounds of ground beef as a precautionary measure because of concerns of potential contamination by E. coli. The product was produced on April the 9th. It tested negative for E. coli as part of Excel's test and whole program for ground beef. Well, last week, the Agriculture Department notified Excel of a positive test sample taken from a business that had reground some of the product. Excel packaged the ground beef in 10-pound cylindrical tubes, which listed a use or freeze-by date of April 29, 2004. The product was likely repackaged by retail grocers, and Excel has provided signs to its customers for use in retail stores. Excel advised consumers that they may want to ask their grocers whether any of their product was involved in the recall. Most of the product likely has been consumed, but some could be in consumers' freezers. We've already contacted our distributor customers so that they could alert the stores that ultimately received the product, said Bill Rupp. He's the executive vice president of Excel. Working with USDA, we decided that we would do the recall as a precautionary measure. The product was produced at Excel's Dodge City, Kansas facility, and it was sold to distributors in Kansas, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Missouri, Alabama, Illinois, Texas, and Minnesota. No illnesses have been associated with the product so far. Excel has established a consumer hotline. You might keep in mind that hamburger is a poor substitute for meat. Hamburger has 30% fat by law. You can get hamburger with less fat. In our state, it runs 9, 20, and 30%. Keep in mind that the scripture prohibits the consumption of animal fat. Hamburger has 9, 20, or 30% fat by law. And it's the ground nature that causes the E. coli problem or process. it has many more surfaces to become infected with E. coli as opposed to a steak, which has two surfaces. Now, when you grind it up, it has thousands of surfaces. So when we eat lean meat, we're a whole lot less likely to ingest the E. coli. Now, there's a second factor that comes